This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. Today, our special guest is David Bloom with Whiskey Hill Farms. Interesting conversation. Hang around for that. First off, let's talk prices for a moment. Looking at cattle 2022, Kevin Good with Cattle Facts.
We're starting the year trending higher from a cycle standpoint. You got Fed values that are in the upper 30s against 140 today, and you've got a yearling market that's close to 160. You got a calf market close to 190. A cow market in the mid-60s, all of those would be as high as we've seen for a number of years starting the year. And so we do think the trend, you know, is higher as we go not only through 22 but beyond, looking at the dollars in the system. And again, that comes down to the leverage conversation. And we frankly think as you go into tighter supplies and you add shackle space, you will see more of those dollars trickle back down to the producer.
This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. We're joined today by David Bloom. David is with Whiskey Hill Farms, owner, operator. I think the business card, David, says Chief Soil Doctor and Regenerative Ag Innovator. That's a mouthful, but welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Tony. Yeah, I try to keep busy, and so the longer the title, the more people call you, you know. They wonder, what's that?
Well, you are using closed-loop regenerative ag tech models, really, to build communities here. How did you get that idea? I know you've kind of touched on it here, but you're a principal advocate, right?
Well, I am. You know, I never had much affection for that term sustainable agriculture. I was sitting around with some of my agriculture buddies back in the day, and we said, you know, there's got to be, what we're doing is not sustainable agriculture, because what is sustainable agriculture? It means, well, let's make sure that the future generations have the same level of resources we have today. And that sounds all flowery and nice, you know, until you realize what you're really saying is, let's not screw it up any worse than it is now. In other words, you know, we're not talking about making it better. We're just talking about not letting it get worse. And so that wasn't good enough for me. So, you know, I think that a really, you know, good system and certainly a good farm is improving its capital asset, meaning its soil, every year. So my soil organic matter at the farm I am at now started at below 2%. It used to be a flower farm with 5 acres of glass greenhouses and outdoor space, too. And I'm up now to 15% organic matter in my soil. And I just kind of take seeds and throw them out there, and they explode when they hit the ground and grow faster than I can keep up with. So, you know, when you make the soil really alive and really bringing out the best in it, you can't help but have healthy crops.
You know, can this help some of our local economic challenges as well?
Well, I think so, because I think a good farm is, it needs to be woven into the community, because nothing is more basic to a community than good local food. You know, we can't, I mean, here you are out in Texas. You've got a lot of good produce produced in Texas. You know, what we're talking about that part of the country, and I'm all the way out in California. So, and then Florida, of course, where you are, that's another big stretch again. But, you know, California supplies a huge amount of vegetables to the whole country. And there's something really wrong with that. I mean, I like California. I'm a Californian. But, you know, if I'm sending oranges, you know, to Texas, or I'm sending something like turmeric to Florida, you know, I got to wonder, is that the best way to do agriculture? Wouldn't I rather have it closer to home and, you know a little bit more about where it's coming from and not have it be 2-3 weeks old by the time it gets to me? Because the average supermarket, you know, produce is 10, 12, 17 days old before you get to buy it. I mean, you know, a turnip is trying to sprout again before you buy it in a supermarket, because it's still alive and it hasn't figured out yet that just because it's out of the ground, it should stop growing. And of course, that means that beautiful, sweet turnip that you couldn't have eaten when you just pull it right out of the ground and rub it off on your, your genes and just bite into it, you know, it doesn't taste like that after 2 weeks. It tastes kind of like something you play softball with. So, you know, those of us who grow food, well, we know the difference, you know, between something that's really fresh and something that isn't. And, you know, we organic farmers, I'm one of those, you know, there's something that we don't have a meter for or a measuring tool for. And if we don't have a way to measure it, well, then it doesn't exist in science, right? But we farmers, we can feel something that we can't use a tool to measure. And so can people who eat fresh food, which is this weird thing called vitality, you know, the liveliness of the food that you're eating, the energy of food separate from its nutrients, you know. It's like when you're right there at the start of the apple season and you bite into your first nice crunchy apple and it's like, oh my, you know, that's what it's all about. And so, you know, there's another way of looking at proving what vitality is. I'm not trying to make it some kind of weird California thing, but you know, when they irradiate food, you know, to make it preserve, what you're seeing when you can leave a glass of milk on a counter for like 3 months after it's been irradiated and it doesn't get eaten by bacteria. Well, if the bacteria don't want it, wow, there's something really different. Even though the nuclear guys who irradiate food say, oh no, you can't see any difference between an irradiated peach and a normal peach. You know, and they're saying, well, you can't measure any difference in the chemistry of what's inside that peach. But that peach will sit there on the counter and bacteria don't even want it. And so you know by observation that something's missing. We just don't have a good way to measure it, but any farmer knows exactly what it is, which is it's this energy of life that is in what we grow.
You know, it kind of makes me wonder here, because we're touching all around this idea that food is medicine or can be medicine. What's keeping us from connecting those two links?
Well, there, you know, there used to be an old saying, the difference between a a poison and a medicine is the dose, you know. So food has always been our primary medicine. You know, it's you know, and in my farm, I specifically look to medicinal crops that actually have important effects medically or medicinally, in addition to just being good food. So, for instance, I grow a crop that's usually found in India called turmeric. Now, most of us have heard of turmeric nowadays, and it's a little bit tricky to grow, but it has powerful, powerful anti-cancer, antiviral, many other medicinal features. And we now see turmeric. Heck, we even see it in Pete's coffee nowadays at the coffee bar. But, you know, turmeric is added to juices all the time. And we're making liquor out of turmeric at our distillery here in California. I mean, there's no reason why liquor can't be somewhat good for you if you have the right things you're making it with. But we also grow wasabi here, which is it repairs the nervous system. It is antiviral, anti-cancer, and is actually used commonly. The extract of it is used in fighting cancer. And there's dozens of articles about this done by government agencies that say, wow, that stuff really works. And it's a weird little plant that grows in streams in Japan. It's considered the world's hardest crop to grow. It's got to be above 40 degrees and below 80 degrees, you know, and you get outside of that, it gets very unhappy. And it takes a year before you can pull that root and sell it. But when you sell that 1 pound root, you get $150 for it. So medicine, as we all know, the pharmaceutical industry makes money, and medicinal crops make more money than carrots. Let me tell you, I can't make my mortgage payment on carrots, but I sure can on turmeric.
And you mentioned the whiskey there. I kind of brings us now, I think, full circle to the fact you're also an author. Alcohol can be a gas. Tell us about that.
Well, yes, I've been involved in alcohol fuel, which is something near and dear to agriculture, for an awful long time. I mean, before gasoline ever existed, we used distilleries to make alcohol to run the Model A's and T's of the day, and even our tractors, gasoline tractors back in the day. And so we have a long history with alcohol being made on the farm to not only sell as a liquor, but to be in lamps before there was electricity. We were able to read by them at night without all the smoke of kerosene that Rockefeller sold in cities. We used alcohol for, of course, extracts for medicine. You can take most plants and find that the important substances in there that we call medicine are extracted by alcohol. So, for instance, take willow branches. If you chop those up and throw them in a bucket with some alcohol and stir it around a little bit, and then strain out the wood, evaporate the alcohol, what'll be in the bottom of that bucket is a white powder. And that's called aspirin, okay? So, in other words, all of, actually 50% of the medicines we have today from the drugstore are actually extracted from plants, at least initially, and maybe modified a little bit. So, we farmers still are the source of the pharmaceuticals, and like normal farming, we make the good raw materials and someone else markets them and makes all the money. So, you know, when you're doing things locally, it's really possible for the farmer to be part of the pharmaceutical company of your town with, you know, extracts and medicines. And in our town here, Watsonville, we have a couple of really great herbalists that make extracts for some of the stuff we grow, and they sell at a good clip because, you know, two-thirds of the people in America actually use herbal remedies in addition to whatever Western meds they take. We know that plants are good for us, and we know if they're farmed right, that they have a lot of effect on our health. And why is that? Well, over the centuries, we learned what plants were good for us. And so now when we farm them, it's not magic. It's like trial and error. We figured out what works, you know, to keep us healthy.
David Bloom with Whiskey Hill Farms, again online, whiskeyhillfarms.com. It's the Agribusiness Report.
For 40 years, United Ag has been committed to ensuring the vitality of the ag industry. United Ag helps protect your future and the future of your workforce. Join United Ag and take advantage of up-to-date information on pending legislation and immigration reform, advocacy, health benefits, and leadership opportunities. United Ag is here to ensure your farm makes it to the next generation. Join us at www.unitedag.org. That's unitedag.org.
If you don't push yourself, how will you know what you're really made of? Cotton Research and Promotion Program works to develop innovative performance technologies that redefine cotton's capabilities and helps athletes push themselves further. Cotton Incorporated is working hard to educate consumers about cotton's versatility, especially in the athletic apparel market. Forever Cotton. Visit cottonboard.org/forevercotton. Welcome back. You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. Special guest today, Ed Bloom with Whiskey Hill Farms in California.
Texas Corn Producers serves the state's corn farmers through both the Corn Board and the Association. The board is putting your checkoff dollars to work in research, promotion, and education to ensure producer profitability and market expansion. The member-supported association is the farmer's advocate in Austin and Washington, D.C. on issues from the Farm Bill, water and property rights, and more. Join the Texas Corn Producers Association today and get the latest news and information about Texas Corn Producers efforts online at www.texascorn.org.
You can't choose when your farm equipment goes down and needs maintenance. Livingston Machinery understands that. Whether you're farming in the heat of the day or in the dark of night, we'll be there to get you back up and running with 24/7 parts and service. With quality AGCO parts and the best service technicians in the industry, you can bank on minimal downtime. Trusted parts, trusted technicians, trusted name. Learn more at livingstonmachinery.com and to find a location near you. Livingston Machinery, 24/7 service for your 24/7 operation.
Welcome back. It's the Agribusiness Report. Again, Whiskey Hill Farms, available online, WhiskeyHillFarms.com.
It's that time of year you've been waiting for. Commodity Classic is back, March 10th through 12th in New Orleans. Join the Sorghum Checkoff for a learning center session, Finding the Sweet Spot, combining precision agriculture and conservation to build a sustainable and diverse farming landscape. Don't miss this cross-commodity, cross-sectoral collaboration with Pheasants and Quail Forever and Cotton Incorporated. Register online at CommodityClassic.com or listen to it live here. Sorghum, the smart choice.
When it comes to farming cotton in West Texas, the formula for success is simple. Put strong in, get strong out. That's why growers rely on Delta Pine brand cotton, bred, tested, and made in West Texas for West Texas growing conditions. Strong is a legacy all its own. Protect yours with strong cotton from Delta Pine. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
It's the Agribusiness Report.
High path avian influenza confirmed now in two more states, a commercial broiler facility in Fulton County, Kentucky, and a backyard flock in Fauquier County, Virginia. USDA is quarantining those areas, depopulating the flocks. That Virginia flock's only about an hour from the commercial turkey farm of David Hughes in Newmarket, Virginia, and he told us at his operation, biosecurity is very tight.
I keep the doors locked to my poultry houses so people can't just walk in. And also have disinfectant at each entryway, and also another disinfectant pan when you actually go in with the birds.
Plus, workers in the poultry houses wear boots that are only worn inside the houses. David does not share equipment with other farms either, and he has many other precautions. He's concerned because in 2002, he had some birds suspected of having the virus, and as a precaution, the facility was depopulated.
And I understand that. I understand. I did get indemnification from the federal government for that, those birds I lost.
But he does not want to go through that again. Gary Crawford, Washington.